2 in Hyannis.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight we're looking at how one church responded to the emotions its parishioners faced after September 11th, not through its sermons or its prayers, but through its music. But first, a sweet and sour note for the ailing economy. New unemployment figures out today are not encouraging. Earlier I spoke with the Wall Street Journal's Greg Ipp and asked him to add up the damage and whether he sees any signs that things are turning around.
Well, the headline story is not an encouraging one. The unemployment rate went up to 5.8%, which is the highest since 1995, and we continue to see overall payrolls declining as employers slash jobs to get their costs in line. But hidden behind those sort of headline bad numbers, there was actually some potentially very significant good news. And the most important thing is that the average work week in the manufacturing sector actually grew fairly sharply. And that's something you often see just before the economy begins to recover. The theory goes like this. If you're a business and you think sales are going up, but you're really not sure, then often what you will do is you'll ask the workers you have to work longer hours because it's a bit costlier to go out and hire people. So if that expansion in the work week holds, it would be consistent with a very quick end to the recession.
Are we talking overtime hours there or people who've been brought back from reduced schedules to work?
It's a bit of both. I mean, we do overtime hours definitely went up. And the overall work week, even outside of manufacturing, also went up.
And yet the layoffs are still there in large numbers. What sectors were hardest hit in this last round of reductions?
Well, manufacturing payrolls continue to go down. So clearly it's a mixed bag. There are some employers that are seeing things so good that they need to ask their people to work longer, but others who are still troubled by the outlook and they're cutting jobs. Retail trade also hard hit, probably because it did not turn out to be a gangbuster holiday shopping season for a lot of stores. On the other hand, construction held up, no doubt, helped by the warm weather in December, and we got a nice kick to employment from the government.
Mm-hmm. And Greg, what about Alan Greenspan? He used to be everywhere, in the air, all-powerful. Now, I think there's a feeling that he's sort of disappeared. Where does the Federal Reserve figure into all this? Can we expect more interest rate cuts? Do they matter at this point?
Well, you know, you got to look at Alan Greenspan's record and say this guy has been in, running the Federal Reserve since 1987, and he's presided over, in that very lengthy period, over the longest expansion on record. And, yeah, it seems that we've got a recession here, but you have to give the guy credit. He started cutting interest rates in January, and he kept cutting them again and again and again, more aggressively than perhaps any Federal Reserve has done in the post-war period. And the fact that the recession we've had so far has, in fact, been by historic standards a mild one, and one that, as I mentioned, does show signs of ending soon, that those positive facts, I think, need to go towards the credit of the Federal Reserve.
So he may still come out smelling like a rose, but do more interest rate cuts figure into this recovery?
Right now, the market is really divided on that. If you looked at the way the market was trading, that you would see that they're pricing in only a small possibility of one more cut in interest rates. The theory being like this, that if in fact the economy is past the worst spot, then there really is no more need for aggressive easing. And with the federal funds rate at 1.75%, which is the lowest since the early 50s, it's probably a lot lower than it ought to be on a long-term basis. And at some point, the central bank has to move to bringing rates back up to a sort of a more of an equilibrium level. And while the point of rising rates might be several months off, it seems certain that the last rate cut, if it's not already behind us, is only a month or two away.
Greg, we loved your page one lead in the Wall Street Journal this morning. The economy could be turning around. Well,
yeah.
Well, yes, it could. But you had a list of signs to watch for. What would be the signs of a turnaround in your mind?
We've tried to put together a list of some of the most important factors that have been driving this recession and suggest ways of looking at them to see when the recession will be over. We'll start with capital spending. Clearly, this recession has been driven overwhelmingly by businesses cutting their spending on equipment, especially technology equipment, and on new factories and buildings. Mm-hmm. And we have seen some positive signs on that front. Another thing you have to look for is an end to this profit squeeze. Even though the recession itself has been mild, it's been perhaps the worst profits recession in decades. And so we really need to see some relief on that front for companies to feel like they have the cash on hand to do any more hiring or investing. And there are faint signs, but only faint signs, that that might be happening. Another thing to look for is inventories. A lot of the decline in production has simply been because businesses have decided to fill their orders out of inventories instead of make new stuff. And at some point, they run out of inventories, and they've got to start firing up the factories again. And we do see signs of that, certainly in the car sector.
Then you also talked about high-end homes. What's the gauge there?
Well, another special factor going on in this recession has been a tremendous loss of wealth because of the huge decline in the stock market. And one of the first places you saw that take effect was in some of what I call these tech hotbed type markets, like Silicon Valley, Seattle, Austin, Texas. And the first place you saw it hit was on the very expensive luxury homes that were being bought by these newly minted millionaires with all their dot-com stock. That part of the market has been very hard hit. And when it starts to come back, I think that would be an indicator that the so-called wealth effect has stopped exercising this downward pressure on the economy.
And your last factor was the Gary Condit factor. What's that about?
Okay, well, I'll be the first to admit that this is not a rigorously demonstrated economic mathematical relationship. But it does make some intuitive sense that back in the summertime, when the media couldn't find anything more exciting to write about than a relationship between a congressman and a missing intern, that it was kind of representative of how placid the outlook was. And the fact that Americans were willing to read about that stuff suggested they didn't have a lot of other things to worry about. Of course, we know that all changed after September 11th, and things about, like, bombs on airplanes and terrorism and anthrax, that made people very worried and probably contributed a lot to a hunkering down by consumers. When we start to see those frightful headlines being crowded off by the, shall we say, more trivial type of news, it's probably not a bad indicator that the consumer is going to be starting to feel a little bit more secure.
Greg Ipp is a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from Washington. Perhaps no one in the music world has had to grapple more with the shifting events and motions since September 11th than the men and women who each week fill churches and temples with music. Each week, these organists and music directors have scrambled to respond musically to the quickly changing needs of parishioners and sermons. There were weeks of shock and grief, weeks of unity and war, and then the holidays, the new year, and a yearning for healing and rebirth. One church that grappled with the musical challenge was the famous Trinity Church in Boston's Copley Square. Its magnificent 125-year-old sanctuary has a history of being a place for comfort, unity, and healing for the city. Yesterday, we sat at the organ bench with Brian Jones, director of music at Trinity Church, and with associate musical director Michael Kleinschmidt to talk with them about how their church has musically addressed the events since September 11th. I am delighted to be with you in this beautiful setting with all of you this afternoon. Thanks for gathering here. We're in the chancel of Trinity Church in Copley Square, Boston. Beautiful church, famed for its architecture. This year, celebrating its 125th anniversary of the building. And we want to dig back into the last few months in the musical life of this church. Brian Jones, your director of music, tell us, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, what had you been planning and how were your plans changed? How did you begin to think about capturing the enormity of that day's events in music?
Well, of course, immediately we realized that because of our location in Copley Square, we were uniquely positioned to offer a lot of solace and healing to the city. So the first thing we did was to agree to have the church, of course, remain open as it does, except that very first day when there was a threat of damage to the Hancock Tower. Beginning the next day, we were open as usual, and we had a number of services each day. And then Mayor Menino asked that we all have services on Friday, so we had a very large service on Friday at noon, and I have never seen so many packed in here. I think it's a good thing the fire commissioner wasn't here that day.
And tell us about your process of thinking about the musical offering that you would have on that Friday service on the following Sunday. This must have disrupted all of your plans. You must have had to go into a quick huddle and say, what are we going to do here?
We did. I think one of the things we thought about right away was what amount of patriotic music we'd sing, because right away the thought was that that was more important than it had been in many years for most people. And, of course, we just wanted to think of the thing we think of all the time in response to any given situation or high holy day or whatever, and that is to make it appropriate. So I guess we started, as I recall, with the kind of music which would just reach people at a place of tremendous vulnerability and, in some cases, anger, sorrow, confusion. So for the service on Friday, we leaned quite a bit in the direction of patriotic music. We opened, as I recall, with the Star-Spangled Banner, And it was pretty extraordinary. I played the introduction, and we started singing, and I could hardly hear the organ people were singing with such richness. It was quite amazing.
We don't have that packed crowd today, but let's hear what that would have sounded like on the organ here in Trinity Church. Those great pipes going way down deep with the Star Spangled Banner. It must have been years since that was played inside this building. Did you have any second thoughts about mixing the sacred and the secular at that moment, or did it seem necessary?
Well, the clergy and musicians have talked about the role of patriotic music in the church, and I think that the rector and our priests feel that the first role of the church is not patriotism, it's preaching the word of God, so that we probably don't let it figure as prominently normally as we did on that particular occasion. And it struck me that in that particular situation, it was very appropriate.
And were these on the first Friday after September 11th, or was this the Sunday service?
That was the Friday service. There was no choir for that. We had just the clergy and the congregation, which was immense. And then on Saturday, we had a service which we had planned before Mayor Menino asked to have the service on Friday. We had almost 90 people from the choirs singing at that, and again, it was a full house, and we had more choral music and organ music and hymns at that service.
We'll hear some of that. Michael Kleinschmidt, you're also an associate music director here. Do you remember what was the sacred music that sat alongside the Star-Spangled Banner in that service? Do you recall?
Well, we wanted to be sure and include hymns that would be broadly known, and so on at least two occasions, we started with O God, Our Help in Ages Past.
Jones, do you know the lyrics offhand, or do you need?
Yes. Oh God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter from stormy blasts, and our eternal home. And then there was another verse: time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all people away. They fly, forgotten as a dream, dies at the opening day.
That's a hymn I know well from childhood, and,
yeah.
And what a rock to hang on to
it
in
is,
a time
yeah.
of
dismay. It's often
dismay.
Sung at funerals, too. That
hymn. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the words are really a reworking of Psalm 90, so people can open their Bible if they don't have a hymnal and ponder Psalm 90.
Tell us about the organ. What are you playing here?
The organ is really two instruments, one in the chancel in the front of the church and the other in the gallery in the rear. About 4,000 pipes in the organ in the nave or the rear of the church, and about 3,000 in the front for a total of 7,000, built in 1926 and rebuilt in the 1960s, and the front organ new in 1960. And they're pretty extraordinary instruments, and they sound wonderful together.
They certainly do. Michael Kleinschmidt, the weeks that followed that terrible day took all of us into realms of shock and grief and confusion and bewilderment that were unusual as hearing the Star-Spangled Banner in this church. Describe for us some of the progression of your thinking and the music that came out of it as you sought over the following weeks to respond to that progression of emotions.
Well, I remember sitting in one of the very first meetings we had after the crisis began with clergy and musicians together and planning what hymns would we sing on Sunday. We had planned the Sunday services a couple weeks beforehand, and we had a whole liturgy set to go, and all of that got changed. We completely changed the hymnody, and the preaching, of course, took a new direction. And I remember one of the first hymns that came to mind for all of us, I think almost simultaneously, was a hymn called All My Hope on God is Founded. And there's a stirring line in the middle of one of the verses of that hymn that says, towers and temples fall to dust, but God's power, hour by hour, is my strength and my trust.
Mm.
And
what
so
could
that,
be more appropriate
that
for that
went
day?
Down, yeah, that went down right away.
We'll talk more with Brian Jones and Michael Kleinschmidt after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This hour, we're taking a look and a listen at how one church responded musically to the events of and since September 11th. Many have turned to the church over the last several months and find they get as much strength, hope, and comfort from the music as they do from the liturgy and sermons. Yesterday, we visited Trinity Church in Boston's Copley Square and met with the director of music, Brian Jones, and associate director, Michael Kleinschmidt.
Brian and Michael, I wanted to ask you, first of all, this collided with all of our lives, including your musical lives here in the church. What got bumped? What got pushed off of your schedule, your musical program, by the events of 9/11?
Well, we follow the lectionary, which means there are prescribed readings for each Sunday on a 3-year basis, week by week. And we program our music and, of course, the liturgy and the preaching and the whole service around those texts. And we thought that even though we would continue much of our emphasis on those, that we had to refocus the music. And
but you also have Friday recitals here in the church.
Right. Every Friday, September through mid-June, roughly. And that Friday was the beginning of the series, and I was scheduled to play. And I had scheduled a program about a month in advance so I could practice and be ready that included, of all things, this very fun set of variations on the Austrian national hymn, which goes like this.
Sounds very familiar.
Yeah, and it's a hymn that many Protestants and Catholics today sing to that tune, but it also has imperialistic overtones from the time of the Third Reich, so I thought, well, that's got to go.
So this was Deutschland, Deutschland über alles during Hitler's time.
That's right.
And that was bumped right off the menu.
Yeah, I just thought that would not be the right time to play that. So everything got bumped, and Brian and I decided that after the Friday noontime service for the city of Boston, we would offer a half-hour program of organ music of consolation and strength. Mm. And we pooled our repertories and came up with a set of mostly gentle pieces that, in our experience, have brought people consolation and strength.
Can you give us a flavor of something that was played there?
Yes. Actually, Michael played a piece which is a great favorite of both of us by a French organist, the organist of Notre Dame, Cecil Piece. And let me play one while I'm seated here. I'll play just one other piece that also fit quite well, the Bach air from the orchestral suite in D, which you may recognize. Beautiful piece. And
the French piece.
Yeah.
Can you give us a flavor of that, Michael?
Sure. It came to mind because it searches. This music is searching for something. And I think, I mean, one of the things that I know I went through was, why did this happen? We were searching for answers. So this piece begins with the statement of an ancient, ancient tune from the Gregorian chant repertory, and then it constantly plays that tune over and over and over in different guises, and finally the organ gets louder and louder and louder, and the music just bursts forth into a radiant statement of that theme thundered out in the pedals.
We're in Trinity Church in Copley Square, Boston, talking about how one church, one organ, one choir grappled with the great issues raised by September 11th. That was Michael Kleinschmidt. And that piece, Michael, again was?
That's the so-called Roman Symphony by Charles-Marie Vidor.
Fantastic. I want to bring in now Mary Beth Conroy. Mary Beth is a priest with Trinity Church, associate minister for community life. And Mary Beth, I wanted to ask you, the musicians have to decide what they'll play, and they have to play it in such a way that it reaches the congregation. As a priest, you feel the congregation's yearning. Do you share that with them? And then as you watch the congregation, what were you sensing and feeling in response to this amazing music?
We are incredibly aware of the power of music in our lives in a way that words cannot respond to a tragedy as great as this. Anyone who faced the daunting task of preaching knew there were no words to describe mm-hmm. what had happened and how people felt. And yet when people gathered here by the hundreds and thousands, the words were helpful, but the music took people to another place. Somehow they were wrapped in the consolation and love of God, whether they knew the tune or not, whether they had a bulletin or not, mm-hmm. whether they had ever sung or been in church. We found a huge number of people who came here who were completely unchurched, unaware of how worship works, how music works. But we saw them bask and rest in the love of God through the work of our choir and our organist.
Are you actually taught in your training for the priesthood that there are times to step back and let the music take over, or is this just something you know intuitively, instinctively?
I think anyone who comes out of a liturgical tradition as ours knows that there's a time to step back and let the music take people to that place. And Christian worship from its earliest times was a worship of singing and song, not of spoken word. So certainly in our tradition, we are taught that there is a time and a place where music takes the front stage and we step back and let people know God through the words and the music.
And is there a coordination that goes on? How does that work in coordinating the messages from the pulpit of a given Sunday and what will come from the organ and choir? How's that coordinated, or is it? Are you on your own track, or do you make it mesh somehow?
Well, as Brian mentioned earlier, we follow a liturgical cycle, so we know 3 years in advance what the Bible readings will be for that Sunday. So we work very carefully, the clergy and the musicians, to coordinate that we give a unified, solid message.
I suppose whatever is on the calendar scripturally, you can find meaning in it that applies to the tragedy at hand.
I think that's the great gift and challenge of preaching, is you try to find always God is speaking to us through scriptures that are assigned randomly, and we search for that carefully.
Brian, talk to us for a moment about the choir's role here. We've looked at some of the hymns that you've played, but you've got a substantial choir here as well. What were some of the pieces that you came to with the choir? How did you come to them? What was your thinking? What did you pull out of your repertoire to use this fall?
Well, we have a number of pieces which we use on such occasions, and they seem to have added resonance and an incredible sense of appropriateness at this time. One piece which comes to mind, I think, first of which we all thought of immediately, is a spiritual called There Is a Balm in Gilead.
Sure.
It's a wonderful piece to start with, but we also have a wonderful man in our congregation who sings in the choir and has since become very active in our parish, a man named Dana Whiteside. And there's something about Dana singing that, so it's sort of become the theme song of Trinity Church, and it couldn't have been more appropriate and healing for a situation like this.
There Is a Balm in Gilead, and Lord knows we all needed a balm at that time. What else were you playing, Brian, or was the choir singing?
Another piece that is a great favorite. In fact, it's a favorite piece to the extent that people ask for it sometimes at weddings, and it's really a piece for a funeral, is this piece called Pia Jesu by Andrew Lloyd Webber, who's, of course, known for his shows, his famous, mm-hmm. many famous shows. This is from his Requiem. It has two soprano soloists originally sung by Webber's then-wife, Sarah Brightman. And we have a couple of wonderful soloists who can sing it very beautifully. That was another very appropriate piece. Mm-hmm. Another piece which we've had tremendous response to is this piece called Jesus Christ, the Apple Tree, which is an ironic situation because the text was written in New Hampshire in the 18th or 17th century, and the music was written by a 20th century English woman named Elizabeth Poston. And that is a piece, musically and textually, is just the most wonderful piece. It likens Jesus Christ to an apple tree sitting in the shade of the tree and this kind of thing. It's a very, very unique text.
What are some of the lyrics there, Brian Jones?
The tree of life my soul has seen, laden with fruit and always green. The trees of nature fruitless be compared with Christ, the apple tree. His beauty doth all things excel. By faith I know, but ne'er can tell, the glory which I now can see in Jesus Christ, the apple tree. And then just one other verse of the five that I particularly like. I'm weary with my former toil. Here I will sit and rest a while. Under the shadow I will be of Jesus Christ, the apple tree. A couple other pieces. We sang a piece from the Fauré Requiem by the French composer Gabriel Fauré. We sang a Russian piece called Salvation is Created in the Midst of the Earth, a man named Chestnikov wrote. They're just pieces that, both in their text and the sense of the music, speak to people, and they spoke very vividly in this context.
Could you hear in the performance of the choir through this fall and winter the extra emotion that we were all feeling? Was it expressed? Did you feel it in your own playing of the organ? Did you hear it in the choir's music? Did you hear it in the congregation's singing of the hymns? How did that come through?
Well, I think emotion is something we're always trying to get at, trying to express. And I'd say probably my chief goal as a choir director is to get people into the emotion of the music, into the meaning of it, into the words. And I often say to them that the music is the servant of the words, not the other way around. It's easy for choirs to fall in the trap of just singing the notes. So we're always trying to get things to make sense and to go someplace to have motion and line and shape and meaning. And I'd say that it was probably a little easier because of all these emotions. And perhaps the most vivid memory I have of the fall is at the service on that Saturday right after the September 11th. We had rung around the circular part of the chancel, which is much the best place to sing in the church. They were singing some of these pieces, and I was noticing probably at any given time two or three people in tears singing. That was quite a vivid sense of conducting people and having them weeping as they sang.
Take us on through the progression of the fall. I guess as a nation, as a national community, we slowly moved out of that shock and grief, though it remained. But at the same time, we came to a different phase of anger, of action, of determination. The president gave his big speech. It was announced that there would be a war on terrorism. Did you find yourself responding to that in your musical programs?
Well, one almost spooky thing, it was an interesting sort of bit of synchronicity, was we had programmed, as we have for the last few years, a concert on the first Sunday in November, which is All Saints Sunday. And we have this program, which is really for All Saints, All Souls Day, which is evocative of people who have died and gone on. And we had programmed a piece because of our 125th year, written by a man who was organist here and dean of the Yale School of Music, a man named Horatio Parker. He was also a Bostonian. And it's a vision of the eternal city. And it was amazing how appropriate it was. And the thing that struck me about it, it's a very grand and glorious piece with some beautiful tender moments. But it seemed to me by the time we get to that point, we were ready to be more courageous and grand and yet still reflective. And the piece just fit in amazingly well.
balance that work in that concert, we had chosen three other pieces before September 11th, which afterward we thought just could not have been better. Like Brian said, it was kind of spooky, almost as if some invisible hand was at work in getting us ready to deal with the
event. Were these choral pieces or organ music?
They were three choral pieces. One was a choral arrangement of the Litany by Franz Schubert, which is one of his most beautiful songs, a setting of Jesus' Beatitudes, the famous Sermon on the Mount. That bit of Jesus' teaching was an oft-used lesson in the services that we held here right after September 11th. So to have that sung by the choir was especially poignant. And then most poignant of all was a motet by Herbert Howells called Take Him, Earth, for Cherishing, which Howells wrote on the occasion of JFK's assassination. Mm. So locally, as well as globally, that just had a real poignancy about it.
Text from the 4th century. Take him, earth, for cherishing, to thy tender breast receive him. Body of a man I bring thee, noble even in its ruin. Once was this a spirit's dwelling, by the breath of God created. High the heart that here was beating, Christ the Prince of all its living. Not though ancient time decaying wear away these bones to sand, ashes that a man might measure in the hollow of his hand. Once again the shining road leads to ample paradise. Open are the woods again that the serpent lost for men. Take him, O take him, mighty leader. Take again thy servant's soul. Grave his name and pour the fragrant balm upon the icy stone.
Talk more with Brian Jones, Michael Kleinschmidt, and Mary Beth Conroy after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Since the events of September 11th, many have turned to the church or temple for guidance as well as to heal and be consoled. The music of the church, parishioners have often found, met these needs as much as any liturgy or sermon. Tonight we look at how one such church has addressed the palette of emotions that have surfaced since September 11th. Yesterday we visited the famous Trinity Church in Boston's Copley Square and met with music director Brian Jones and associate director Michael Kleinschmidt, as well as Mary Beth Conroy, an associate rector at the church.
By the French composer Gabriel Fauré. Brian Jones or Michael Kleinschmidt, we're going through the progression, the cycle of emotions in response to 9/11 here in Trinity Church. As you got deeper into the fall, a war was underway. There was a kind of national determination, and at the same time at home, a sense of unity, and at some point, a sense of healing beginning. How are you responding with your musical program to that progression?
I think that what we found ourselves doing shortly after the attack was thinking a little further ahead than the people we were aiming to serve. Because, yes, we needed to respond to things that we couldn't see or perceive yet, and events, you know, were unfolding in their own time, but being servants of the church, we are in another place, in another time. We always have sort of one foot on the earth and one foot somewhere else.
Give us an example of the music that fell in that category, pulling the congregation on ahead.
Well, I'm very aware, and this is not musically, but liturgically, that we have made it a priority to pray for our enemies and for those who wish us harm every week since September 11th, which has caught many people short, and we have gotten some feedback from people saying, how can you do this? And yet, as Christians, that's what we're called to do. How can we not do that? So I would say liturgically, we're very mindful of the fact that while 9/11 happened, there are people who wish us harm. There's violence in the Middle East, all over the world, that has continued. And so I think our music has tried to address the ongoing struggle for peace and justice in the world.
So when the music turned to healing, it wasn't only American healing that you were playing for and praying for.
That's exactly right.
What was some of the music that led on into this healing period?
Well, obviously, there's a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. I mean, that's appropriate any time, but especially so after the 9/11 event. Mary Beth?
At our annual Candlelight Carol service, which draws enormous crowds for the city and happens the week before Christmas, we traditionally begin with Once in Royal David City and launch right into O Come All Ye Faithful, which is a very triumphant Christian hymn. And this year we shifted it a bit and took the O Come All Ye Faithful and placed it at the end in the service. Brian and Michael can say more, but had more of a progression of an awareness of how broken our world is at this time.
That's true, and that's a good way of putting it. We sang O Come All Ye Faithful, which is we always think of as the greatest of the carol services, and we do a huge descant, which is a melody soaring at the end. It was upbeat, but not quite so triumphant, and we saved that for the end. And the other thing, in addition to having a progression of things, which started at a slightly gentler place, let's say, trying to catch people where they were, we changed the bidding prayer at the beginning of the service, as it's called, the opening prayer, for one which we love, but which was much more specifically addressed to this fall. And I thought it was really wonderful, the way it took people where they were, and then it kind of said, here's where we are, and here's where we hope to go in this service. And indeed, we did that. And the other thing about the service, which we've been working more and more out of the last few years, which we did this year, is it's very much more multicultural. We sing a broader range of music from various parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And it worked out very well. We had a tremendous response to it.
An example of that?
Michael did a wonderful arrangement of a Chinese carol, which was brilliant. We did a West Indian carol, The Virgin Mary Had a Baby, which is very jazzy and wonderfully rhythmic and just tremendously engaging with drums. That was near the end of the service. And we did a more upbeat setting of I Saw Three Ships, where the choir actually whistled. It almost sounds like Disneyland, and people laughed. And at that point in the service, they were ready for a laugh,
right,
because we'd taken the serious part and dealt with it, I think.
I suppose inevitably with Christmas, with the change of the calendar, the theme of rebirth comes in as well.
That's right, absolutely.
And certainly that's the message of Christmas. And Phillips Brooks, the rector who was here when this church was built, wrote the great words, O come to us, be born in us, our Lord Emmanuel.
In O little town of Bethlehem.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so the rebirth of love and healing is what we've prayed for all through Advent and Christmas. And I think that we do that every year, but it was especially needed and heartfelt this year, I think.
Few of us are organists of your skill, or fewer yet, play on an organ of this magnificence. There must have been moments this fall when the emotion and the scale of events was overwhelming even to you. Do you remember times when you were at the keyboard and the music and your own emotions and the events of this last season were intersecting in a way? You described earlier the choir sometimes being in tears. Was there a moment, Brian Jones, when you found yourself melting into the music in a way unusual?
It happened to me in the third time around at the carol service. Michael was playing, and we were singing, actually it was Angels We Have Heard on High, and And somehow the whole fall kind of came into me, and I just filled up with tears. And it was just something about all we'd been through this fall just overwhelmed me. And it was a wonderful moment. I like moments like that.
And rich and filling as anything you could ask for. And Michael Kleinschmidt, yourself?
Well, it was rather early on. It was that Friday when we invited the whole city to join us in worship at noontime. And as Brian said before, the church was never fuller. He's never seen it fuller. I mean, they were standing three deep in all the aisles. And when Brian was playing the Star-Spangled Banner, I was standing right here next to the organ console singing and just watching these people pour into the church all the way through the service. And they were, the first thing most of them did was to look up as they came in. I mean, the building just draws your eyes upward. And
the grand stained glass, the soaring ceiling.
Yeah, and the organ, as Brian said, was just raging away, and I could hardly hear it because people were singing with such gusto. And it was like a great pressure valve had been let go, and everyone was just really pouring their hearts and souls into it. And I'm not given to losing it, but I did.
I am given to losing it.
Well, this has been a tremendous session, and we thank you, Brian Jones and Michael Kleinschmidt and Mary Beth Conroy at Trinity Church in Copley Square, Boston, for taking us back through the musical cycles of a remarkable season. Thank you all.
Our pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
For more information on Trinity Church or to purchase recordings of their choirs and orchestra, visit their website at www.trinitychurchboston.org. In a moment, I'll be joined by our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen to some sounds of this past week.
Seconds into the arraignment, he stood to address the judge in a heavy French accent. He said, "In the name of Allah, I do not have anything to plea. I enter no plea." The judge then clarified, saying, "I take that."
With intelligence reports suggesting that the Taliban leader, Mullah Omar, may be hiding in remote mountains of central Afghanistan, combat-ready Marines in Kandahar boarded planes before dawn to join the hunt for America's second most wanted man.
Raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Michael R. Bloomberg, do solemnly swear.
I, Michael R. Bloomberg, do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
The Pakistani
that
government can't give the impression that it's backing down to pressure. Both countries have got themselves backed into a corner, and however much they say they don't want a war, it's difficult to see how they can step back from the positions they're in now.
Yasser Arafat has delivered calm in recent weeks, but without political progress, that calm won't last. General Zini's last mission here ended in failure, and this one may be no different.
The Republican agenda in Washington today is being written by a wing of the Republican Party that isn't interested in fiscal discipline.
We had a Special Forces member killed earlier today by small arms fire in the vicinity of Gardez Caste. As I have a chance to speak to you this afternoon, I am mindful of the cost that these great young people pay in order to support this very, very important campaign.
And there are the sounds of the week. Zacharias Moussaoui in court, the hunt going on for Mullah Omar Mohammed, Michael Bloomberg being sworn in, Pakistan and India simmering, U.S. General Zini going back to Israel, Tom Daschle bringing politics back to politics, and Tommy Franks today announcing the first U.S. casualty as a result of enemy fire. Jack, the sounds of all this are beginning to sound like normalcy.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? Elections, politics, third world conflicts. But let's talk about one of them, the Pakistan-India face-off. We had Jessica Matthews of the Council of the Carnegie Endowment on last night, and she talked about a range of treaties, international agreements, Europe's for, the United States is against. One is the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Here are two countries, India and Pakistan, that got the bomb. And if there had been a comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty backed up by international sanctions, perhaps they wouldn't have got the bomb. So the question is, what's in America's interest? Do we want two more third world countries to be able legally to test bombs because underground, because there's no comprehensive test ban treaty? This is one of those occasions. It looks like it's just between India and Pakistan, but really it has a lot to do with what is the real threat to American security.
But as we heard this week, this conversation about America participating or going it alone is still very early days. There's not a turnaround yet. It's still pretty high in the saddle, Washington is, isn't it?
It is, and but as again she pointed out, the talk of multilateralism is just that. There has been very little multilateralism from the Bush administration. What they have said to these countries is, join us or not. And if multilateralism is expressed in willingness to join international agreements, nothing.
On the home front, not so much willingness to agree either. Tom Daschle coming out swinging this week on the stimulus plans and on the Republican posture in general over the economy.
Yes, but very timidly. I mean, he's criticizing the Republican economic program, saying they're going to have to raid the Social Security Trust Fund in order to pay for the war. But he's not saying that we should rescind any of the Republican tax cuts. And so it's okay, you're criticizing them, but what are you going to do about it? Barney Frank, representative of Massachusetts, said, let's rescind the tax reduction that would cut the rate for the top earners, save $100 billion over 10 years. That's not going to go anywhere, probably. Paul Krugman points out in the Times today that the parties have never been further apart on economic philosophy. And it really, he says, it isn't that the Democrats have moved left. Daschle is for a balanced budget. The Democrats are all about fiscal prudence. It's that the Republicans have moved right. They have never met a tax that they don't want to cut. And that the Democrats can't make politics out of the fact that this huge tax cut went, 43% of the benefit of it went to the top 1%, that they can't fight that issue out against Bush just tells you everything about a party that's sort of hamstrung around the issue of, we gotcha, you want to raise taxes.
Jack, Zacharias Moussaoui, the first person indicted in connection with the September 11th attacks, today urged a U.S. judge to let the proceedings be televised on cable television. Can you see another O.J. trial emerging here as the 9/11 first guy goes to court, goes to trial?
Gee, I just don't know what that would look like. I can imagine the objections to it, that it would be, a show trial, that he would be able to make propaganda points and so on. But I really do think that the American judicial system is one of our, despite OJ, is one of the things we can really be proud of in this country. The adversary system tends to work, and our jury systems tend to be fair. And just to show that to the world, that's not a bad advertisement for America, I don't think.
Not a bad thing. And then Tommy Franks today announcing the first U.S. casualty as a result of enemy fire after all the bombing. Amazing.
It is amazing. An army of 50,000 people has melted away, and we have lost one man.
One man. Jack, have a great weekend. Good night. Thanks for being with us.
Good night, and thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.